Late Night Live, ideas and opinions from around the world.
And welcome, beloved listeners, to Late Night Live. I don't know if you're listening to us live, but if you are, you probably had a few minutes of dead air, which is thoroughly unnerving. It is said that no news is good news, but in these difficult and troubled times, one can't help but feel a bit paranoid when you get that much dead air. We'll be off to Chernobyl shortly, 25 years after the catastrophe, to see what's been happening through the eyes of an Australian filmmaker. Then we're off to Israel to see Israel's response to the Arab democracy movement. And we're going to round the evening off by talking to Colin McNaughton about St. Patrick's Battalion. This involves a mass desertion from the American army by Irish soldiers who then fought on the Mexican side in the American-Mexican War. But before we go any further, I just want to remind you that it is compulsory, absolutely compulsory, for New South Wales Gladdies to attend the public forum, which we're holding on the Monday following the New South Wales state election. Won't cost you a penny, but there's no excuses will be accepted. That's Monday, the 28th of March at the Eugene Goosens Hall here at Ultimo. Well, I'm not at Ultimo tonight, but normally I am. And we'll be discussing how to rebuild the Labor Party with a panel of guests including John Faulkner, Labor historian, former New South Wales Minister Rodney Cavalier, and others too numerous and exciting to mention. So, of course, you're coming along, but you have to register, and to do that you go to our website, abc.net.au/rn, and tell us how many tickets you want, and otherwise I'll come around to your place and let your tyres down. Okay, let's now look at Chernobyl, and it's almost 25 years. God, it doesn't seem that long, does it? Meanwhile, at the moment, of course, military helicopters are dumping water, seawater, on the containers holding spent uranium fuel to prevent overheating. But there's growing concern that we're about to have a major disaster in Japan. The French Nuclear Agency estimates that the situation at Fukushima is a level 6 accident. That's two up from Three Mile Island in 1979, and that was pretty hair-raising. And although the Japanese authorities are more forthcoming than the Soviets were 25 years ago, getting info about the precise nature of the damage and the exact dangers posed has been, well, uneven. Officials from the EU believe that the disaster is worse than previously thought. The Americans are warning their own citizens, first of all, to bail out of the country, but not to go within a 50-mile radius of the plants. That goes much further than the Japanese officials who've been issuing warnings suggesting clearing a zone of 12 miles. The chief of the IAEA is flying in for a first-hand update. An additional 34 nuclear experts have arrived from the US to monitor radiation levels from the ground and air, joining experts already on the ground from the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Marilyn Fairskye is associate professor at the Sydney College of the Arts at Sydney Uni. She visited Chernobyl twice in 2009 and 2010 to make her new feature documentary Precarious, which will be previewed this Friday night at the University of Technology in Sydney. She's in the Sydney studio. And Marilyn, welcome to Late Night Live. I must say you have an extraordinary sense of timing.
Yes. Hi, Philip. It's a sense of timing that I wish I hadn't had. I haven't quite been able to believe the events as they've unfolded because I have a very strong sense of déjà vu.
Well, I want to explore that, your déjà vus. Of course, Chernobyl was attributed to human error. Japan's problems are not, although one has to question the design of the plant. But what initial similarities do you see in the response to the crises?
Well, first of all, In the first instance with Chernobyl, there was no official response for 10 days, although there was an unofficial response on the ground, but no information was released for 10 days. Information has been released here much sooner. But one of the things I've got to say, my understanding is based on my work as an artist who just gathers material for work, and I don't pretend to have any scientific understanding, but I do see lots of similarities in the way in which, for instance, information is doled out in small bits, and it's doled out in a sort of more optimistic way at first, and then it sort of becomes worse when the inevitable can't be, you know, continually sort of downplayed. There's a lot of improvisation around what to do, and so you see increasingly desperate measures in terms of water being dumped from helicopters. There was sand dumped into the burning core in Chernobyl from helicopters. And, you know, today there was talk about a shelter being erected, a new containment being erected around the breached core. A containment was hastily erected at Chernobyl. I mean, it was hastily erected around Reactor 4, the core of Reactor 4, because people couldn't get too close to it. And so that hastily erected container has sort of containment has now been breached, and it's a source of ongoing concern. About 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it was realised it needed to be replaced or covered or in some way sort of dismantled and the contents protected. And the same thing will happen, I think, here if they attempt to, in Japan, if they attempt to throw something up quickly. There will be problems with it because workers can't get in close enough to it.
Well, one of the dramatic differences to me is that a handful of people are actually working at the site in Japan, whereas 6 days after the explosion, between 700,000 and 900,000 so-called liquidators were moved to Chernobyl to clean up the mess.
That number, it was over a period of several months, like they all weren't there at once.
Well, they couldn't be, could they?
They couldn't
because
be.
Of exposure factors.
Well, no. Yeah. Well, in fact, the guys who were on the roof of Reactor 3 who were removing the rubble that had been thrown out of Reactor 4 when it exploded, they had a count of 20. You know, they'd run up, run out the door on the roof and count to 20 as they ran across, picked up a radioactive lump and threw it over and had to dash off. And so after 3 or 4 days of that, they'd be replaced with others.
There was a remarkable degree of heroism, quite selfless behaviour there, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're seeing the same thing in Japan as well. You know, I can't help but think about those 50 workers who are still there. And I think about, the guys at Chernobyl, and these were young people who were really idealistic. You know, I'm talking about the people who were at Chernobyl. In fact, one of them lives in Sydney now, Yuri Ursel. He was a helicopter pilot, and I've interviewed him in my work.
But what was he told about the risks involved? He had a sense of duty, but was he forewarned about the degree of risk?
No, they weren't, and he certainly wasn't. What he was told was that it was... if he didn't fly the helicopter, somebody else from his unit would have to, and that it was his responsibility and their responsibility to undertake this work, because if they didn't, something much worse could happen. And not only the city of Pripyat, which was completely sort of destroyed and it's now a dead city, but that Kiev itself would also be directly affected. And so they had a real sense that there was a big problem, but they weren't given the actual details of it. And so they were given, you know, little cloth masks that were called petals to stop the dust getting into their throats. And they had just makeshift lead balls to provide protection, which they themselves fashioned within the helicopters, you know, to actually provide some sort of casing for themselves.
The Soviet government was in denial, wasn't it? And the kids continued to drink milk and eat contaminated food. And it was a bit long before locals were evacuated.
Locals were evacuated from Pripyat, which was the town, the city immediately near the reactor, you know, within 2 days. But in terms of the outlying areas around what's now called the exclusion zone, it was often months before, you know, there was a proper evacuation. But nonetheless, people have moved back into those areas, some of those areas. And because of the economic circumstances in Ukraine, lots of people are hunting and fishing, you know, on contaminated ground.
Mm. What about the long-term health effects? It is said by the UN Scientific Committee that there's been a rise in thyroid cancer, a spectacularly significant rise.
I think I'm not really, you know, qualified to comment on that. But what I do know, and, you know, one of the people in my film, Professor Igor Shapotin, he's head of the Oncology Institute in Kiev, and he was also at the time of the accident treating people who were showing up at his clinic with symptoms, radiation symptoms. And he says that the full effects of radiation and, you know, related sort of contaminated sort of air and other products take 25 years to realise themselves. So 2011 is the year that things will come to a head in terms of premature deaths, people who are dying before their time, you know, if they hadn't been exposed, the onset of different types of cancers as well as thyroid cancer. That was the most obvious one, and the one which could, in fact, be treated early on to a certain extent with iodine tablets, which I believe this is what the Japanese officials have dispensed to people around the reactors today.
Earlier this week, Bruce Shapiro, who's in the business of trauma, dealing with journalists principally, said that, made a fascinating point, he said that there's quite a few studies that show that people cope better with natural disasters than they do with technological disasters, that they're more deeply upset by failures of technical systems because they see this, in a sense, as betrayal. I'm wondering about the long-term effects on the psyches of the Ukrainians. It, of course, happened in the Gorbachev era when the whole joint's coming unstuck anyway.
Well, there's a huge psychological effect, and, you know, it can be said that that, in fact, is as strong and as changes the course of people's lives as much as more clearly identified medical effects, you know, physical medical effects, because apart from the fact that, you know, there was that such a strong element of state secrecy where people felt really powerless and helpless. And then once Ukraine separated, you know, when the Soviet Union broke up and Ukraine became independent, it was left with this giant burden, this huge financial burden in terms of addressing the problems from the explosion, which were truly immense. And that also, you know, created, if you like, a class of medical citizenship where people were vying to, you know, be assigned degrees of incapacity in order to get access to what, in fact, were very small benefits. And that creates its own sort of psychological framework, if you like, that's not really...
I bet party members got to the head of the queue.
Well, I think it was, you know, everyone for themselves for a while there.
Yeah. Okay, well, Marilyn, thanks for coming on. Listeners, if you're in Sydney, you can see a preview of Marilyn's film Precarious, followed by a Q&A at the University Hall at the University of Technology. It's 7 p.m. tomorrow night, or tonight if you're listening to the repeat, and after a little bit of music, Israel and the Unrest in the Middle East, LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and the web.